My story is long and complicated. And what I want to do with this episode is to create basically and use it as an executive summary to talk about what happened at a high level, what happened at Immaculata in the late 70s, early 80s, basically 77 to 81. Then what happened at St. Louis U High from 82 to 86. My abuse at Immaculata by Father Leroy Valentine, abuse that was witnessed at least in part by then Father, now Cardinal Timothy Dolan at the Church of the Immaculata in Richmond Heights, which is a suburb of St. Louis. And then sexual exploitation and worse that occurred at St. Louis U High, starting in the locker room at St. Louis U High, and then there was an incident with a Jesuit in Haiti. If you haven't seen the movie Spotlight, you probably should because I'm going to be referencing it a lot, and that's because St. Louis is basically Spotlight, but worse. What is going on in St. Louis is very similar to what was going on in Spotlight era Boston, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, when things broke. But it's worse, which is impossible to believe, but it's the truth. You've got the Missouri Attorney General involved. You've got the press involved in the cover-up. Basically, so some of the key scenes in the movie Spotlight are where people are asked to make a choice. People are literally asked by members of the church to cover things up, to do the church a favor, to remember the church. And in that movie, they refuse to. They push back on that. What's so horrible about the situation in St. Louis is that people were asked the same question, and instead of saying no, they said yes. That's what I mean by when I say that St. Louis is Spotlight, but worse. And a lot of what I'm talking about is a problem of how the church is organized, in that each diocese is a little fiefdom, and what happens in Boston doesn't necessarily have much, if any, impact on what happens in St. Louis. And that's exactly what's happened. You've also got the fact that the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, the USCCB, is basically powerless. Every bishop throughout the country and the world runs his own fiefdom, and he's accountable only to the Pope. The USCCB is kind of a PR exercise and can issue guidelines that they want bishops to follow and that bishops usually agree to follow, but they don't actually have to follow those. Bishops are only accountable to the Pope. So that puts all the onus on the Pope, and as I'll discuss at the end, the Pope is letting survivors down. The Pope is our only hope, and he refuses to do his job. And what's worse, he's passing laws, a law called Vos Estis, which gave me and other survivors a lot of hope. Because it was supposedly going to help us, but Vos Estis is a sham. So let's talk about what happened. You know, my memory, the memory that I have and that I've always had, is of what I call that day, which is the worst day. And basically, the memory involves. And this is a memory I've had probably 15 or 20 times, enough that I remember it and I know that it's a thing, but not so much that it led me to be suspicious or obsessive about it. Basically, the memory picks up with me in the rectory at Immaculata at the west door, the screen door, the outside screen door with my looking at the latch on the door, pressing the latch, turning the corner around the door, and then bailing out of the rectory. And as I run to get around the corner of the Church of the Immaculata over by Clayton Road, my eye level jumps as if I'm hurtling. Then I turn the corner, run down west on Clayton Road, and end up under a tree on the other side, the north side of Clayton Road, and wondering, you know, what the hell just happened. So that's all. How I got to that point involves Father Leroy Valentine coming to the Church of the Immaculata in the summer of 1977. I would have been in fourth grade then, so it's, while my later stuff involved me being an altar boy, you didn't actually start serving until fifth grade, so a lot of these memories are before I was an altar boy. And basically everything started in face-to-face confession. I had done the dark, scary room confession up to that point, and then in the fall of 77, I assume it was the fall of 77, at some point they offered this new option called face-to-face confession, where, and the way it was set up in Immaculata was you had the cry room where the moms would go with the babies. They would draw the curtains of the cry room, which I assume were also used for weddings, if they had any weddings there. You know, they had the curtains there so they could kind of seal off the room for privacy. So they would draw the curtains and just have two chairs in the room for face-to-face confession. It would just be you and the priest. And during those confession sessions with Father Valentine, it started off with hugging, and then it got progressively worse, involving groping, and I'll go more into that detail, but basically everything started during face-to-face confession, where Valentine had, you know, unfettered access to kids in during face-to-face confession, because, you know, like I said, it was the cry room, the curtains were drawn, there were just two chairs, and there was no barrier to prevent him from getting at us, and he would, under the guise of hugging us and tussling our hair, and, you know, my head would end up in bad places. At around the same time, if not just slightly afterward, Father Valentine started throwing parties for the boys. And the memory I have is of a party. This is probably November of 77. There's still a few leaves on the tree, but they're mostly down, and it's cold and it's wet. My mom drops me off at the rectory at Immaculata, and I run in to have a Risk party, play the board game Risk. Basically, we would eat pizza, Panteras, I think, drink Coke, real Coke, not Vess or RC, and we would each get a can, which is a big deal. So we would have this pizza Risk party, often accompanied with wrestling. I have one memory of basically wrestling with Valentine. And what he would do is he was obsessed with teaching us how to wrestle. And what would happen is his hand would slip, quote unquote, slip. And he would end up touching you down there. He'd touch your balls, and, you know, I think that happened to everyone. That was the whole, you know, that he would teach the boys how to wrestle, and then the two boys would be wrestling, and someone would do something wrong, and Valentine would demonstrate a move, and that's when his hand would slip. So that's the Risk pizza party. And there were three other guys there, TM, AM, and RB are the guys that I remember from my memories. And I just remember sitting at the kitchen table. I was sitting at the south chair looking north with the dining room kind of behind and to the right of where I was looking. I have a separate memory that I assume happened on that night involving a TV room where it's essentially... And in my first memory of being in the kitchen table, there are only three of us there. There's someone across the table, someone to my right, but the seat to my left is empty. And I think what happened was that person was in the TV room with Father Valentine. And I had my own turn in the TV room. And I don't remember this in too much detail. I think I've kind of blacked it out. But basically, he would sit on the sofa watching TV. And the TV was an old style cabinet TV. It was a long, thin room with a cabinet TV on the left. And then there was a sofa opposite, and you and he would sit in the sofa, and he would touch you while you were sitting on the sofa with him. That wasn't the only time he would do stuff like that. I have some memory of being up in his room and his, one guy called it haircuts. I don't remember if it was a haircut or what exactly the guy's was, but I ended up in Father Valentine's room with him, sitting on the bed in his room with the door open, and he's playing with my hair. He loved to play with my hair. Basically, whenever I get triggered, it involves my hair. When my hair gets too long, that's a problem because it reminds me of back then. And it's funny. It's 2020, April 10th, in the middle of the COVID-19 outbreak. And I'm trying to figure out how the hell I'm going to cut my hair because it's getting longer and it's starting to bother me. And the reason it bothers me is it's flashing me back to Father Valentine. You know, and with this being Holy Week and Easter, that's a bad memory anyway, but this is a really kind of miserable time for me. But so Father Valentine would take guys up to his room and, you know, play with us and show us stuff and play with our hair. And one of the worst things is that Father Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan of New York, would be around in the rectory along with Monsignor Flavin, and they would see stuff and nothing, you know, they never did anything. Another memory that I have is his taking three of us, and I've got a picture of this, to a mud cave, I assume down I-44. And I know that on the ride back from the mud cave, he sexually abused me. He touched me. So I remember waking up from a nap and looking at him and thinking how much I hated him and how he disgusted me. And I think what had happened is that he was molesting me while I was asleep. And I don't remember telling my parents about that memory, but I do remember how strong my reaction was when I woke up. I've talked about this with the therapist, and he said it was probably a flash of insight where I was starting to figure that out. And that would have been seventh grade, December 26, 1980. So I would have been halfway through seventh grade, you know, starting to figure stuff out. And I have this memory of staring at a man's chest, and I wonder if that happened after the mud cave trip. If I ended up back in the rectory with Father Valentine and and I've wondered about showering him and all that kind of gross, horrible stuff. And I think the worst stuff happened was probably the summer of 79. I've got a bunch of memories. Another memory that I have is of special training. I don't know whether that was 78 or 79, but basically Father Valentine called me up to serve an old people's mass for him. And while there'd normally be two or three guys there, I was the only server there. So I served it alone with him. And then after the mass, he showed me a bunch of stuff in the sacristy. And that involved his touching me and groping me and sexually exploiting and abusing me. Not a particularly pleasant memory. But that, I call that special training. And I know that he got at other guys in a similar circumstance where he would have you come up alone and serve a mass for him, and then afterwards he would do stuff and stuff would happen. Where were your parents? That's a question that I've gotten a lot, and one I should probably answer. Well, and it's relevant to, you know, the worst stuff in that day and the worst day. And the literal answer to that question is they were on vacation. When the worst stuff would happen, well, for one thing, I would just be, you know, I would just walk up to church and serve the mass by myself, which was normal. And I didn't, like with the special training stuff, I didn't understand what he was doing to me. I didn't report it because I didn't understand it, much less know that it was bad. And he would also, during the special training, he would do things to distract me. He gave me tasks. He told me some BS stuff about how I was consecrating and how I had to be really careful. And basically that got me so focused on the task that I didn't notice what he was doing to me. And that stuff and the worst stuff happened when my parents were on vacation. They would go on vacation over every 4th of July to either the Broadmoor in Colorado or to a place in West Virginia I'm blanking on. The Greenbrier. My mind goes blank when I talk about this stuff. That's what the pauses are, as I'm trying to fight through these, this kind of blanking out of my memory. But say, so they would be at the Greenbrier, and somehow Father Valentine knew when they were going out of town, and he would set up these events. Now, my mom dropped me off at the Risk pizza party. My mom dropped me off. I remember her dropping me off and picking me up. I assume she picked me up. You know, and in her view, and the view at the time was that, you know, a priest was the safest person in the world. And it was really an honor to be asked to hang out with a priest. So that was, you know, that's where my parents were. That's what happened and why. And nobody thought anything about it. Was they thought it was an honor. I did start to show signs of a problem. I had one fainting episode that I think happened, I assume happened in probably fourth grade. I was right at the base of the stairs at Immaculata. There's kind of a T there right outside the cafeteria, and then there's like a multi-purpose room in a hallway that leads to a couple lower level classrooms. And I remember passing out, and I believe it was at the realization that Father Valentine had just kind of walked up next to me. And I had another episode like that in, at the seventh grade, all student back to school mass. I think that would have been, well, that probably would have been 80. That would have been August of 1980. At the back to school mass. So it could, so that, you know, the worst stuff could have happened. No, I don't know whether the worst stuff happened in 79 or 80. It really doesn't matter. I think stuff was happening all over the time from 78, 79, 80. is when the worst stuff was happening, because that's 78 would have been when I started serving. And Father Valentine was there until summer of 81. So I had another, regardless of what year it is, I don't know why I can't think about this. Well, that would have been 80, the summer of 80. So August of 80, I had this fainting episode at the back to school mass. Mrs. Martinego and Sister Helen both saw it and took me back in the church. But again, I didn't know what it was related to because I didn't understand what was happening to me. I didn't remember most of it. And what I did remember, I didn't understand. That's probably the simplest way to put it, the best way to put it. Yes, there was some repressed memory involved, but not everything was repressed. But the stuff that wasn't repressed, I simply didn't understand what he was doing to me because I had no conception of sex. And I didn't lose my virginity until after college, although that's probably related to this, you know, to what happened to me. Mrs. Martinego did notice that things were happening to me and or that I was changing, and she was my fourth grade teacher, so this would be 77, fall of 77, winter, spring of 79. Mrs. Martinego did once say something to my mom, and my mom said something to my dad, and I don't think they knew it was anything more than like depression, or they noticed a change in my moods. And my dad did some reading. I don't know exactly what he did reading about, probably depression. But they decided that all I needed was kind of more hugs. And that's... So the stuff that they did notice, they tried to solve with hugs. And I, you know, they're not psychologists, so it's hard for me to hold them to blame for what happened. There are people I get frustrated with because, as I've come to find out, everybody knew about Father Valentine. Not literally everybody, but a lot of people knew what was going on, and there was a lot of talk, and people were telling each other to watch out for him. And what frustrates me is that nobody told me. Nobody told my parents. It seems that generally the people who figured out what was going on with Valentine, they protected their kids, and that was it. And that gets back to the Dolan thing that I mentioned. Father Tim Dolan, now Cardinal Tim Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, came to Immaculata straight out of the seminary summer of 77 or 76. And then, so then when Valentine came in the summer of 77, Dolan and Valentine were there together. And Dolan saw at least some of what was going on, and he knew at least some of what was going on. Dolan knew that Valentine had a thing for boys, and he saw it with his own eyes, and he didn't do anything to intervene. And Dolan is difficult for me because he'll come back up in the story in 2002. So in early March 2002, a piece ran in the New York Times talking about Father Valentine and someone else who had a run-in with Father Valentine. Not at Immaculata, this is, you know, 5 years later or so. So that led to a New York Times piece, which then led to a Post-Dispatch piece, which led to a bunch of other coverage in the St. Louis media. And that led the prosecutor, Jennifer Joyce, to put out a call for people to come forward. And the Archdiocese of St. Louis also put out a call for people to come forward. So I did. I called Jennifer Joyce, told her kind of at a high level what happened. Never heard back from her, I assume because of a statute of limitations problem. But I did get a call back from the Archdiocese of St. Louis, and it was, my call was returned by then Bishop Dolan, who I had known as Father Dolan at Immaculata, Father Tim Dolan. Now, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Archbishop of New York. You know, hey, Chris, Tim Dolan, Bishop Dolan, how you doing? Been a long time. So he asked me, you know, what was up, why I called in, and I just said, you know, they asked people who might have information to call in, so I did. I spent a lot of time with Valentine. I knew him probably better than anyone. So I told Dolan my memories, what I remembered. It wasn't everything. It wasn't the worst day, but it was, you know, it's a lot of really kind of questionable stuff. But Dolan immediately, without any investigation, told me that it didn't mean anything. And he told me definitively that nothing happened. That, you know, he had been with Valentine at the seminary. They lived and worked together in Immaculata. He knew that Valentine did not do any of the things that he was accused of, that Leroy Valentine could never do anything to hurt a child. And that was good enough for me, mostly. But then, you know, and I had known Dolan since 76. He's my first memory of a priest, and I trusted Dolan. I thought he was a good, jolly guy. And when Dolan tells you nothing happened, you believe that nothing happened. Now, he did make an offer to have me see an independent psychologist who I suspect was, I don't remember her name, but I suspect it was Nancy Brown, the assistance coordinator for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. Dolan sold her as being independent, but she was actually the assistance coordinator. I had a conversation with that woman, who I assume was Nancy Brown, and she also told me that nothing happened, that my memories didn't mean anything. She told me that I was misinterpreting, and that was her word, I was misinterpreting Father Valentine's actions, that maybe he, you know, if he had done anything, he was just overly enthusiastic. And I remember having a conversation with my uncle Denny O'Leary later that summer, talking about that, because somehow the topic of the abuse stuff and the Valentine stuff came up, and I mentioned that I had some exposure to Valentine, but, you know, that I'd talked to Dolan and I'd talked to Nancy Brown, and they both told me that nothing happened, that I was just misinterpreting it. Which is weird, because in late March 2002, I only found this out, you know, in the last year or so. In late March 2002, Father Valentine resigned. I think it did actually make it in the paper, but for whatever reason, I missed it. Or I didn't see it, or I didn't want to remember it. I don't know. I don't remember it. But so Valentine resigned. And it turns out it was due to at least two other guys came forward with allegations against Valentine. And Dolan never let me know about that. He never circled back to me to say, hey, Chris, you know that stuff that I told you didn't mean anything? Well, maybe it did. I've got two other guys who said similar things. Dolan never did that. He never contacted me again. So I just went on with my life thinking that I'd dodged a bullet, that I'd been lucky. And just for timing, speaking of cardinals, That all happened under the watch of Cardinal Regali, and then Cardinal Burke took over St. Louis. So they're both implicated in Valentine, because what happened is when Valentine resigned in late March 2002, the Archdiocese of St. Louis basically cut him loose. I believe he lived in a private residence. So Cardinal Burke and Cardinal Regali both sicked Valentine on an unsuspecting public. Valentine wasn't secured until some number of years later. That's March 2002. So I just went on with my life. You know, I had just had a baby. My youngest was just a couple weeks old. You know, I was in the trenches, busy with a young, growing family. But then in I assume it was February 2003, my older son made his first confession, and I had a panic attack at Mary Queen of Peace standing against the west wall of the church, that kind of fancy marbled wall by the door, by the side door. And I broke down taking my son to confession. And then in what I assume was February 2005, I think Mary Queen of Peace at the time was doing first confession in like February that year, and then they'd do first communion in April. So February 2005, I have another panic attack when I take my older daughter to her first confession, this time with Father Meyer. First time it was with, I think, the pastor of St. Elizabeth. Second time was Father Meyer. In both times, the kids went to the dark, scary room side, so then I went to the face-to-face side, and I had to the face-to-face side, and I hadn't been to confession since I left Immaculata. I don't think I ever went to confession at SLU, which I never thought was a thing, but, you know, obviously that's kind of suspicious. So I have panic attacks and 2003 with my older son, 2005 with my older daughter. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? So I actually ended up calling the New York Times reporter, Lori Goodstein, who wrote the piece in 2002, and asked her a bunch of questions and basically point blank asked her, do you believe this stuff about Valentine? And she told me we wouldn't have run the story if we didn't. Which kind of gave me pause, and but I didn't know what to make of it, because Father Valentine, or Father Bishop Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan, had told me nothing happened, and Nancy Brown had told me nothing happened. So, and none of my memories were completely clear, and I had repressed some stuff, so I didn't know what the hell to do. So I just, again, I just kind of went on with my life in 2005. I did send an email to David Clossy of Snap at the time, but I never followed up with him. I was very confused about what the hell was going on and what it all meant. But by 2007, I had become what I later found people described as catatonic. I was laid off from my job at Equifax. Previously had been Tox. And like I said, people had described me as catatonic, but instead of helping me, they just laid me off, which is pretty hard to process. By spring of 2008, going into the summer of 2008, I had what was pretty obviously a PTSD, my first PTSD episode, where I had this episode of what my psychologist think was fear, but it felt like anger. A really, really bad anger, a murderous rage, which scared the hell out of me and is one of the reasons why I stopped leaving the house. Kids were out of town with Laura and in Colorado, and it just kind of freaked me out, because I think what had happened is I had spent all my life up until that point protecting them, and suddenly, well, and they just missed a tornado when they were driving out to Colorado, and suddenly I was no longer in a position to protect them. They were 1,000 miles away from me, and I couldn't protect them, and I guess it scared me, but it felt like anger. And that was the scariest part, was how much anger I felt. But then things kind of went downhill from there. I started having anxiety problems. Spring of 2009, I was trying to do my own consulting around elevator pitches, and I wasn't able to function. I had a presentation to do and ended up having a panic attack around that in the Lake of the Ozarks, and didn't completely screw it up, but it didn't go well, and that really shook me up, because I'd never had any problems doing presentations before. I'd never had problems with panic attacks before. Now suddenly I couldn't function. So by Holy Week of 2011, I had been talking to a psychologist and was wondering about stuff, and I think he was starting to wonder about stuff, because I had been having a lot of psychological problems, and every road that I'd gone down hadn't panned out, and basically the only thing that was left for me to consider were these memories I had about Father Valentine. So I started digging into those. And by May of 2011, well, it started in April of 2011, I had started to wonder whether something had in fact happened. So in early May 2011, I went back to the Archdiocese of St. Louis, spoke to a review team, investigatory team, with the purpose of basically asking them, are you sure my memories don't mean anything? And there was a problem with that meeting. Well, during that meeting, they told me that my memories didn't mean anything, that it was all my dad's fault. Now, there was a problem with that meeting that immediately threw me, where there were supposed to be no lawyers involved. And in fact, the Archdiocese had two lawyers at that meeting. I hadn't been given the opportunity to bring a lawyer. I didn't realize that it was going to be a legal thing, but the Archdiocese of St. Louis protected themselves by having both the Huegers were there. Bernie and Christine Hueger were there at that meeting. But so basically the gist of that meeting, the outcome, the sense I got out of that was that they were telling me that nothing happened. You know, I had gone into that meeting asking them, are you sure these memories that I had told, that I had told Dolan didn't mean anything? And they're like, yeah, they don't mean anything. Plus, we have no record of your conversations with Cardinal Dolan, or then Bishop Dolan. So somebody had covered up that meeting. I don't know if Dolan had done it or someone else had done it, but they denied having any knowledge of my having met with Bishop Dolan or Nancy Brown in March 2002. I don't know if that was gaslighting or they really didn't know. You know, perhaps Dolan had hidden everything from the Archdiocese. I don't know. I did contact Deacon Phil Hangen, who was supposed to be my contact, and kept asking him for help. He gave me the runaround. At one point, or a couple times, he did ask me for a treatment plan, but he never offered to pay for the treatment plan. And, you know, I was having money problems, and I couldn't afford to pay for the creation of a treatment plan. And like I said, Hangen in the Archdiocese never offered to pay for it. And it turns out that I didn't realize this until about a year ago, that the policy of the Archdiocese in effect now and at the time was that they don't help survivors. The only thing they do to help survivors is if you're a survivor and you come to them for help and you don't have a psychologist, they will give you the name of a psychologist. They won't pay for anything. But that's actually, I've since come to understand, that's why Hangen didn't do anything. All he did was give me the runaround, is he had no authority and no desire to help me, because the Archdiocese of St. Louis does not help survivors. Didn't in 2011 and still don't. They won't pay for anything. I guess they think that giving you the name of a psychologist is help, but it's not. It's certainly not the hardest part of getting help. So I spent a couple of years trying to get help, ended up trying to go over Hangen's head to Monsignor Richard Haneke, who I knew from St. Elizabeth. He was just as useless. It was just run around. And then one of the worst days of my life was in May 2013, when the Archdiocese of St. Louis permanently removed my abuser, Father Leroy Valentine, and never called me to help me or to warn me or anything. They just dropped it out of the blue. And that literally destroyed me for year and a half, where I just was unable to function. Unable to get anything done. You know, how do you remove a guy and then not help me? I've made all these allegations against him and they refuse to help. But I've since come to learn that, you know, their policy is they don't help survivors. Things got worse. in January 2014 when the Archdiocese of St. Louis published the Matrix, which is a legal document that was ordered to be produced as a result of litigation, kind of civil litigation, and the Archdiocese lied in the Matrix. They committed perjury. I was not in the Matrix, and I know I've since come to learn of other people who were not in the Matrix. The Archdiocese lied to the court about my existence and the existence of other people in January 2014 in the Matrix, which was they were ordered to produce as part of a court filing, court process. That was hell, but not the worst hell, because now we get into the abuse of what I call the abuse of the abused, that basically began in December 2017, with the death of Cardinal Law. The USCCB, Council of Catholic Bishops, put out a press release related to that, that basically, as an aside, they said, you know, any survivor who needs help can go to their diocese and get help from an assistance coordinator. So then I tried to alert the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, the USCCB, this is January 2018. I tried to alert them to the fact that the Archdiocese of St. Louis wasn't helping survivors. You know, I thought, okay, these are good people. These are Catholics. They want to help people. So I decided I would just let them know, okay, the Archdiocese of St. Louis isn't helping survivors. They don't have assistance coordinators. I had never been offered the help of an assistance coordinator. But again, as I've since come to learn, the Archdiocese, by policy, doesn't do anything for survivors. You know, the USCCB can tell them to do this, all this stuff, but only the Pope can force a bishop to help survivors, and the Pope refuses to do that. And I'll get into more about that in a little bit. But, you know, I tried to alert the USCCB to it. Turns out they didn't care. And then that's when the Archdiocese of St. Louis started coming after me, and all of what I call the abuse of the abused began. So, it's January, February 2018. I'm trying to get help from the USCCB, thinking that they actually care about survivors, thinking they would be upset that the Archdiocese of St. Louis isn't honoring their assistance coordinator promise. Turns out they don't care, or at least they don't have any power. As part of that process of trying to blow the whistle on the Archdiocese of St. Louis and alert the USCCB to the fact that the Archdiocese of St. Louis doesn't honor the assistance coordinator promise, I did end up getting this email out of the blue from Sandra Price, she basically took over for Phil Hengen at the Office of Child and Youth Protection. She sent me an email, a private email, basically obliquely admitting that it happened. You know, your claims, the legal term, or the language was, your claims were acknowledged, which is kind of legalese that maybe means that they admitted that it happened, but it could also mean nothing. But so I get this email from her that isn't an explicit acknowledgement that it happened. So then I followed up Holy Week 2018 with another email asking her if she could kind of explicitly admit that it happened. And my whole process of trying to alert the USCCB to the fact that the Archdiocese of St. Louis doesn't help survivors, that first led the Archdiocese of St. Louis to accuse me of having made terroristic threats against them. So I get a visit from the Shrewsbury police late February, early March 2018. They seem convinced or worried that I'm going to commit a mass shooting, which of course I'm not. I was just trying to get help and saying, you know, USCCB is making these promises. The Archdiocese says all this stuff about survivors. I'm just trying to follow up on that. And it just pissed them off that it pissed the Archdiocese of St. Louis off that I would actually try to follow up on that and hold them to their promises. So then they ended up making this bogus allegation to the Shrewsbury police that I had made terroristic threats. I'm visited by two detectives who are investigating that, and they start following all my social media stuff. I made some social media posts that I were intended and I think were obviously defensive in nature, but the Archdiocese of St. Louis said that those were actually terroristic threats, which was BS. And that was really hard for me and made things even more difficult, because that played into kind of the worst fears that I had as a result of these PTSD episodes, where I did have these unmanageable spikes of fear that they were probably fear, but they felt like anger, and I felt like I was losing control. And as a result, I didn't want to leave the house, and all, being accused of having made terroristic threats by the Archdiocese of St. Louis just made everything worse. I did end up kind of coming forward in a piece by Aisha Sultan of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in April 2018. That caused another survivor to kind of circle back at me, and we started DMing via Twitter. He had a very similar story, a lot of which overlapped with my experiences with Dolan and the fact that Dolan saw stuff and did nothing. I referenced that a bunch. But kind of the worst thing from a moral support standpoint was a statement by the Archdiocese of St. Louis spokesman Gabe Jones, who basically called me a liar in that public statement in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And that led everybody, you know, my parish completely cut me off. My kids cut me off. I lost the support of everyone except for my immediate family, my brothers and my parents. Everyone else just abandoned me. Because, you know, hey, the Archdiocese of St. Louis told everybody in the Post-Dispatch or via the Post-Dispatch that I was a liar, and people believed the Archdiocese. I ended up standing vigil outside of the Archdiocese of St. Louis massive reparation. I laugh because, you know, this is a massive reparation, you know, for the abuse and for survivors. This is September 2018. And so I stood vigil outside the massive reparation, and I was completely and totally ignored by the Archdiocese of St. Louis. There were 100 priests lined up just, you know, tens of feet, 30 feet away from me on the steps of the Cathedral Basilica, the Archdiocese of St. Louis. Archbishop Carlson was there, and everyone just ignored me, which was just absolutely stunning. As a result of some of the posts, the Pope's, he convened a summit, a sex abuse summit at the Vatican, February 2019. That led the Archbishop Carlson of the Archdiocese of St. Louis to make these public statements about how he wanted to meet with people. So I took him up on that. And in March of 2019, I ended up meeting with Archbishop Carlson and Sandra Price, the head of the Office of Child and Youth Protection. I assumed that Carlson knew what was going on, but I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. So I basically told him everything that had been done to me and asked him for help and asked him to end this. You know, I informed him of the smear campaign, asked him to end the smear campaign. Basically, you know, just said, if you want to claim ignorance of this and just start over from the beginning, I'd be glad to do that. They refused to do anything. The Archdiocese of St. Louis ended up just stonewalling me, where they wouldn't respond to any of my emails for a follow-up meeting, or, you know, I would ask them, so are you going to do anything about any of the stuff that I asked you for? They didn't really promise anything at the time, but, you know, they're doing all this horrible stuff, and they're a church, and there's Jesus and all that stuff, and you would think they would do the right thing, but they didn't. And as I emailed them asking for follow-ups and trying to put pressure on them, eventually they just stopped replying to my emails. in the summer of 2018, the Pennsylvania grand jury report came out, and the Missouri Attorney General at the time, Josh Hawley, opened an investigation into the Archdiocese of St. Louis. That was then picked up by Eric Schmidt. And in September 2019, Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt held a press conference to discuss the results of that report. Now, Schmidt is a Catholic, and I had immediately gotten bad feelings about that investigation when Schmidt took it over, because a family member of Tom Albus, who I know from Mary Queen of Peace, and Albus is the first assistant attorney general for Schmidt, under Schmidt, I had gotten the sense that they were trying to protect the Archdiocese of St. Louis. They viewed that what they needed to do was protect the Archdiocese of St. Louis from survivors. So I tried to attend that press conference in September 2019, was thrown out of the building by the Missouri Attorney General's office, and I wasn't protesting or doing anything. I literally just wanted to be there in the room when they announced the findings, but the Missouri Attorney General's office wouldn't allow that. They threw me out of the building. Not for protesting, just for standing quietly in a corner. I've since gone to the FBI to tell them my story. They don't care about the Missouri Attorney General's office. They don't care about any of that. I did have a relatively recent meeting with the FBI where I informed them of the mud cave trip that Valentine took me on. And it turns out that Valentine very routinely took guys on trips. In my case, he took me down Highway 44 to a mud cave. I've heard that when he was at Immaculata, Valentine also took guys down I-55 to Mount Tomsock, that kind of thing. But it turns out that when Valentine was posted in North St. Louis, he would take guys to Per Marquette Park. And to get to Per Marquette Park, you have to cross over into Illinois, and that makes that action a potential federal crime, because you're taking minors across state lines for illegal purposes. So I've informed the FBI in St. Louis, the St. Louis office, of potential violations of the Mann Act. And I found out about the Mann Act because of the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing. The FBI hasn't, I don't know if they're doing anything. They haven't followed up with me. I don't know if they're referring it to the district attorney. But I've informed the FBI at a minimum of potential violations of federal law by Father Valentine. But nothing has happened. November 2019 is an episode that I refer to as a bad touch, where basically I went to a prayer service and a member of the Archdiocese of St. Louis, Sandra Price, ended up touching me in a way that led to a massive flashback and caused massive kind of problems for me. I was just trying to attend a prayer service and talk to Archbishop Carlson afterwards, and Price ended up touching me, and that led to a lot of really bad things. Most recently, so in the summer of 2019, I was approached by a woman whose mom had long believed that the woman's husband, the mom's son-in-law, had been abused by a priest. I guess she just got a weird feeling from her new in-laws. So the woman, the wife, contacted me, kind of wanting to ask me some questions about what does it look like if you've been abused, because she wanted to know if her husband fit the profile. And it turns out I know the family from Mary Queen of Peace. And essentially after some time talking, she revealed to me that the then priest, now bishop, had been sending their family money for some number of years. The implication being that it was hush money to keep her husband from saying or doing anything about the abuse that he suffered at the hands of this then priest, now bishop. So in the course of trying to investigate that and investigate this then priest, now bishop's past, I ended up doing some research into the history of abusers who had been at Mary Queen of Peace. And I know that Valentine had gone to Mary Queen of Peace right after Immaculata, so I'd already been wondering about what had happened at Mary Queen of Peace, if people had been abused or not. I ended up finding a document that I regard as the smoking gun, because it basically, it shows that there were three abusive priests who came through Mary Queen of Peace in the late 70s, early 80s, mid to late 70s, early 80s, and they came in back to back to back, one after another. So obviously, there was a slot at Mary Queen of Peace for a troubled priest. And the phrase troubled priest is one I had learned from my dad, because I think the same thing happened at Mary Queen of Peace, where the Archdiocese of St. Louis knew that they had within their ranks certain numbers of troubled priests, guys who had problems with attraction to minors, with kids. And they had these slots at Mary Queen of Peace, and I believe also at Immaculata and probably other parishes, for these quote-unquote troubled priests. And obviously at Mary Queen of Peace, they'd rotated three of these guys through. And I learned that because this document was produced based on admissions that the Archdiocese of St. Louis had made in the fall of 2019 about, you know, who the bad priests were. And in that document, the Archdiocese didn't give any dates and postings, but it turns out that Mary Queen of Peace created a document that laid out the names and times that four priests, three of whom came in back to back, had been at Mary Queen of Peace. So that's basically the smoking gun in terms of what happened, because it was obvious from reading this document that these guys were being managed, and to manage someone requires knowledge. So now I've got a document that proves that the Archdiocese of St. Louis had both had knowledge of predator priests in the mid-70s, late-70s, early-80s, and they were just kind of running these guys through Mary Queen of Peace just as they ran them through Immaculata and other parishes. I can't get anyone to care about that, though, which goes back to the point that St. Louis is like Spotlight, but worse. You know, in Spotlight, the movie, the press, while initially screwing up the story, ended up doing the right thing and reporting on the story. That's not what's happening in St. Louis. You've got the Missouri Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, seems to be working to protect the Archdiocese of St. Louis and the Catholic Church, his church. You've also got the press, KMOX, KMOV, KSDK. They know about the misdeeds of the Archdiocese of St. Louis, and they're sitting on footage. There was a KMOV photographer in the room when I was thrown out of the room by the Missouri Attorney General's office, and that photographer thought that was at least local, if not national news, the treatment of survivor by the Missouri Attorney General's office. But that piece never aired. KMOV is sitting on that piece, I assume in an effort to protect the reputation of at least St. Louis, if not the Archdiocese of St. Louis. The photographer who saw what happened thought that it was at least a local, if not a national story, but apparently the editors don't want that seen. And that's what makes St. Louis worse than Spotlight. The reporters in Boston, of the Boston Globe Spotlight team, were asked to sit on this information, and instead of sitting on it, they reported on it, and they blew it. They blew it up. They did the right thing. So why me? That's a question that Dave Glover asked when I talked to him in June of 2019. And I don't say that as a lament. I think it's simply a question of why is the Archdiocese of St. Louis going after me? They're going after me because of, well, A, because I'm unafraid of them and I'm willing to speak up and speak out against them. Plus, you've got the whole involvement of Timothy Cardinal Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, and people in St. Louis, I believe, still think that he is capable of being elected to be the Pope, and they would shit if they saw if the first American Pope was from St. Louis, people would freak out. And I think the Archdiocese of St. Louis and the people of St. Louis in general are trying to protect Dolan. And that's why they're going after me as hard as I am, because I'm trying to blow the whistle on the Archdiocese of St. Louis and Dolan and expose all of this. Why did it happen? That's a question I ask all the time, and I'm going to do a complete podcast on that. I think you had this idea, and this idea that I still see and that is kind of bubbling up in this COVID-19 stuff, where some people, kind of the more radical traditional Catholics, believe that the Eucharist is more important than individual lives, that it's worth risking people's lives to get people the Eucharist. And I think what happened to us when we were kids is that people decided that it was more important that those priests who they knew had problems were still made priests so that they could do all this priest stuff and give out the Eucharist and grant confessions and everything. It's not like there was a priest shortage at the time. The rectory at Immaculata was full. I think the Archdiocese of St. Louis thought, we've got these guys coming to us. Yes, they're questionable. Some of them are pretty messed up sexually, but they're called by God, and it's more important that we allow them to become priests. And if they rape some kids, you know, whatever. Kids are resilient. I assume that's what people were thinking. They were thinking that the Eucharist trumps all, and that, you know, if some kids get raped in the process, well, you know, so be it. The Eucharist is more important. It's more important that we ordain these guys than that we expel them. I don't know that for a fact, but that's my general sense of what happened and why it happened. That the Eucharist was viewed to be more important than the lives of the laity, than the lives of children, and we were sacrificed as a result of that. I, of course, think that's offensive. I think it turns the Eucharist into an idol. It profanes it. And you've also got the fact that I believe the Catholic Church is using the Eucharist as leverage over people, where, you know, the Catholic Church believes it's the one true church, and that if people want to get to heaven, they have to come to and through the Catholic Church. And that allows the Catholic Church to do things to people and get away with it, because people have to come to the Catholic Church. That's their belief. That's what they believe. That they're the one true church of Jesus Christ, and everything else is an imposter. That's disgusting and profane, but I think that's what's happening. I think that's how people think, and I think that's why it happened. I think that's why we were sacrificed. People thought the Eucharist and the ordination of more priests was more important than the lives of the children who would be raped by those priests. And I think that's why things are still being covered up by the media and by Catholics, and why people won't report on what's going on, as people view the Eucharist and the church as being more important than the lives of the individuals who were sexually abused, exploited, assaulted, raped by priests. As for why the Archdiocese of St. Louis does nothing to help survivors, I don't understand. I assume it's just purely about money. The USCCB has this kind of dual focus of promised to protect and pledged to heal. The Archdiocese of St. Louis only talks about the promise to protect. And while it's great that the Archdiocese of St. Louis is promising to protect children and is working to protect children, while that's a great thing, it's not enough. Survivors need help. I need help. All these guys that I know need help. And the Archdiocese of St. Louis does nothing to help us. And for those of you who are thinking that the Pope and Vos Estis, which is the document that came out of the 2019 February Sex Abuse Summit, for those of you who think that Vos Estis, which promises to help us, if you think that that document actually helps us, you're kidding yourself. Vos Estis is a sham. It's a lie. I've made multiple appeals to the Pope, to the Vatican, under Vos Estis. I've sent 3 letters. I'm about to send another one. I know at least one of those was delivered, hand-delivered by Cardinal Sean O'Malley of the Archdiocese of Boston, put on the Pope's desk, if not hand-delivered to the Pope himself. The Pope, Pope Francis, knows what's going on in the Archdiocese of St. Louis. He knows about the treatment of survivors, and he simply doesn't care. He refuses to enforce Vos Estis. He refuses to help survivors. Why? I don't know. All I know is that Vos Estis, Lux Mundi, is a taunt. It's a tease. It gives false hope to survivors. And it's of Satan as a result. So when you see me on Twitter at Ivan Does Not asking questions like, what about survivors? With bringing up Matthew chapter 7, verse 5, that's what's driving me. The Catholic Church, the Archdiocese of St. Louis, has tons of compassion for immigrants. You got people like Father James Martin who do great work in terms of advocating for LGBT folks. But where are the advocates for survivors within the church? Where are the militant nuns? All the short-haired nuns doing protests, holding signs, doing marches. Where are the marches and the demonstration? Who's caring about survivors? Who's advocating for survivors? In fact, the reality of the Catholic Church, the modern Catholic Church, as of April 10th, 2020, is that advocacy for survivors is a career-limiting move within the Catholic Church. And that can only be of one thing. It's of Satan.